1039, 1450 AM, WKXL, NewHampshireTalkRadio.com. It is Feltus and Kale on this Tuesday, the 2nd of March. Dan, how are you today?
I'm great. Ken, how are you doing?
I am doing very well.
We're back.
We are back. Our contracts were renewed.
That's amazing.
For yet another week, which is truly amazing in our climate today. Today, by the way, Dan, and I'm sure you know this, marks the one-year anniversary of the first case of coronavirus, COVID-19, in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we'll be talking a lot about that today with our guest, Dr. Tom Sherman, who could also be called Senator Tom Sherman.
Sure thing. And, you know, over 1,000 Granite Staters have lost their lives to COVID. We have a worse-than-nation crisis in our nursing homes, and people are still battling it, and it's still having a devastating impact on our economy and public health system here in New Hampshire. So there's a long ways to go.
No doubt about that, and we'll be exploring that topic and more today here on Feltus and Kale. So stay with us, 1039 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. Welcome back, 1039 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. As we mentioned, our guest today is Dr. Tom Sherman, also known as Senator Tom Sherman. And Dan, why don't you introduce the doctor slash senator to our Feltus and Kale audience?
Well, a good doctor is a gastroenterologist actively practicing Exeter Hospital and that area, and just a wonderful person, committed public servant, represents the Seacoast, 11 towns out there, has been a leader on healthcare issues at the State House, working on issues in terms of mental health, in terms of the emergency room boarding crisis, combating the substance use disorder crisis, helped work on Medicaid expansion, you name it, a great guy, a doctor. He's in many cases just what the doctor ordered, Ken.
Ah, I see. More Democratic humor coming our way. Dr. Sherman, how are you this morning?
I'm very well. Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, it is a delight to have you with us on, you know, what is really kind of a somber occasion, this March the 2nd, and the one-year anniversary of the first diagnosed case of COVID-19 here in the state of New Hampshire. I guess I would start by asking you what we know 1 year later. What more do we know 1 year later about this disease?
Well, it's a great question. I've been in practice for over 30 years in gastroenterology, and the virus that I tracked during my career was hepatitis C, which is a virus. It's very different from coronavirus. But just to give you a perspective, when I started my career, hepatitis C was known as non-A, non-B hepatitis. It didn't even have a name. So when they named it, they started doing a lot of work on trying to develop treatment and a vaccine. So that would have been, well, let's see, I graduated med school in 1987. So by 1990, about, we had a name for it. We had some pretty horrible treatments that were, 15-20% effective, using multiple regimens that made patients very sick. But right now, hepatitis C is 97% treatable with, unfortunately, very expensive drugs, and I would say curable in over 90% with these medications. But that is over 30 years. So now look at COVID, and in 1 year, we already have three vaccines available. We understand the DNA, I'm sorry, the structure of the virus. We understand how it works. The amount of scientific evidence that has been developed about hepatitis C, I'm sorry, about COVID is virtually unparalleled in the history of medicine. So, while we think of all the other historic issues that have come forward in the last 12 months, The most remarkable factor for me as a physician is how much we have learned, and not just learned, but also been able to create a quiver of incredibly powerful arrows in our vaccines that are available now to combat the virus.
And Dr./Senator, we have, as I mentioned in the open, a worse-than-nation crisis of COVID in nursing homes. What is being done by the state now to deal with that? You know, we passed a number of measures that were vetoed last year, but what is being done right now to try to get a handle on that scourge in our nursing homes, including at the New Hampshire Veterans Home, unfortunately, where 37 veterans have been lost to COVID. What's being done by the state right now to deal with that?
Yeah, so it's interesting you bring that up, Dan, because clearly that is where COVID has had its greatest impact. We've had tragedies in Exeter Hospital. We lost one of our senior managers to COVID just in the last 3 weeks. So, you know, this number one, it's not over. And anybody who thinks that it's over really needs to think twice, because this is something that will be with us for a while. But the place where we have done the worst and now we are actually doing pretty well is in the nursing home community. What we saw after, you know, essentially we have people who are among the most vulnerable to this virus sitting ducks in the nursing home. They weren't sick because all of a sudden they got sick. They were sick because the virus was brought to them. And the virus was brought to them before we had effective controls, before we had adequate testing. And that's one of the reasons why I and a few other people working with MIT professors created what was called the Senior Support Team. And the Senior Support Team recognized this group. I was the chief medical officer for the COVID Policy Alliance, which was a group of MIT professors that sought me out because I'm a practicing physician. And this group not only brought several shipments of PPE to New Hampshire back in April, but also along with a fellow named Daniel Curtis, we co-founded this group to really try to arm the nursing homes as quickly as possible against the virus. So the vulnerabilities were there wasn't adequate testing, there wasn't adequate PPE, there wasn't a national mandate for face coverings, which was really these fundamental public health interventions like face coverings, social distancing. Those would have saved lives. But the virus got there before those were invoked. And of course, we never had a national mandate, and it took us a while to get a state mandate for these sort of fundamental basic public health measures. That left this group of people incredibly vulnerable. And the Senior Support Team is still active. We report daily to the Commissioner of Health and Human Services.
Hello? We seem to have lost
the...
Go ahead.
We actually have among the highest rate of nursing home and senior residential facility vaccinations in the country. So we're doing very well on vaccinating residents. We're not doing quite as well on vaccinating staff, which is the vector for transmission of the virus. But at the end of March, the surveillance testing, which is really the other major intervention. So there's three major interventions. One is PPE, two is vaccination, and three is ongoing surveillance testing. That expires at the end of March. So we have opened a dialogue with the commissioner to make sure we continue that component beyond March, especially for the people who are not vaccinated.
Our guest is Dr. Tom Sherman, also a New Hampshire state senator. serving District 24, representing 11 towns along the seacoast. And we're focusing right now on COVID-19, 1 year anniversary of the first diagnosis of COVID-19 in the state of New Hampshire. And Dr. Sherman, what have we learned? Now, you, getting back to the masks, however, which is something that, you know, people I have become accustomed to. But at the outset, as you pointed out, there was some disagreement, even among the top medical people, like Dr. Fauci, for example, that were not convinced that masks were necessary at the outset.
Actually, among the top, Fauci and others did not believe that, never doubted that those fundamental public health measures were important. There were people, there was a gentleman who was an advisor to the Trump administration who was actually a radiation oncologist, had nothing to do with infectious disease or epidemiology, who unfortunately had the president's ear and thought that the mask mandate was not appropriate. Very early on, including, by the way, the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston put out directives, and Forbes did as well, talking about how mask mandates would not only help save lives, but also help save businesses and the economy. So I don't think there was, in the bulk of the literature and the experts, there was not much controversy. Unfortunately, it did become political, which was, in my opinion, cost lives. And certainly in our nursing homes, if staff or vendors came in without a mask, that would be, you know, that would be a terrible public health violation and leave those residents at risk.
Tom, getting back to Senator, getting back to the nursing home context specifically, CDC and other best practices is routine testing of residents and workers in nursing home facilities. And it wasn't until mid-November that HHS announced that it would do routine testing of residents in nursing homes. Why did it take that long for the state to do that? It wasn't like there wasn't tests available until mid-November. What was the delay in really taking that proactive step to catch and mitigate outbreaks in nursing homes?
Well, it's a great question, and unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that. It really is something to ask the commissioner. We have known since very early in this outbreak that testing, while we are waiting for a vaccine, testing was going to be the key. Because what testing did, you know, South Korea showed how effective testing is by being able to test, identify who's positive, and then in the medical terminology, cohort or quarantine those who are positive to protect those who are negative is really the backbone until you have a vaccine that's effective. So I don't know the answer to your question, Dan, but I do think that there was a recognition that testing, universal, comprehensive testing, what especially for the at-risk population, was the really serves as the background from a public health standpoint on being able to isolate those who are positive.
And South Korea, you mentioned, Tom, a country of about 52 million people, right, has less deaths due to COVID than New Hampshire, a state of 1.36 million. Let's switch gears a little bit, if I may, to mental health issues, which obviously have been exacerbated in COVID-19. Tom, back in 2019, a piece of legislation you shepherded, Senate Bill 11, I believe it was, to deal with the emergency room boarding crisis in the state, including increased reimbursement for so-called designated receiving facility beds, including dealing with some of the insurance company reimbursement practices that inhibit adequate treatment of folks immediately. And then also a bill that you co-sponsored, work with me on, Senate Bill 14, to do a statewide mobile crisis team for children in distress to keep them out of the emergency rooms. Those were passed in March and then June of 2019, respectively, well in advance of COVID. What has been the delay in this administration to stand up those services and supports for folks who need it? And where is all of that at right now?
Great question. So working with, I would bring Senator Whitley into the discussion on this at some point, because, you know, as you know, she has worked on this issue in children her entire life. Her entire career. SB 11 was really designed to be addressing ER boarding in adults, because
right.
at the time that we introduced that, we had, as you recall, up to 80 to 90 adults boarding in our emergency rooms in mental health crisis with nowhere to go. And some of them were there for as long as 32 days. If you can imagine walking into an emergency room with chest pain, saying, I think I'm having a heart attack, and being told, well, you're going to have to go back in a room because we don't have the resources, and sit there for up to 32 days waiting for a cardiac cath lab. We would never allow that. And I think there's just a false notion that mental health is somehow less important, less impactful than heart disease. And that's just not true. You know, I think of mental illness as a life-threatening disorder, especially for people who are a danger to themselves or others. We think a great example of the impact of mental illness was over at Frisbee Hospital, where a patient actually killed a security officer. This is a life-threatening disorder, whether it's an act against others or suicide. We have the second leading cause of death in the state of New Hampshire is suicide. So in adolescents and young adults, especially in men. So this is a critical component, and what we've seen with COVID is we saw a huge delay in implementation of SB 14, even after the budget had passed. The first, as you know, in the first year of this, we let several million dollars lapse because we had not, or basically go away, because there was not enough of a really rapid movement to implement this. And right now, the remaining dollars are at risk also of lapsing. And that's where Senator Whitley's bill is so critical to making sure that money does not lapse. And the other area where we saw significant deficiency in terms of implementation was in the contracting department. Great people working in that department, but it's seriously understaffed. And with COVID, the number of contracts that the Department of Health and Human Services has to approve and get out have skyrocketed. And so these others that have to do with implementing the children's system of care have languished. And what that means is that we have a perfect storm. We have inadequate services throughout the state. We have a number of children who are in mental health crisis. And so, you know, a few weeks ago, we crossed the 50 children mark. The commissioner and the department have opened up 10 beds at New Hampshire Hospital for Children. They're working hard to try to get Hampstead Hospital to open another wing. We need an emergency measure, which will be less than perfect, and then we need to get these long-term measures that you know of, and that are really standard of practice in SB 14, implemented as quickly as possible.
We have heard about the mental anguish that so many have suffered, in particular during this pandemic, as you just pointed out. Has it impacted a younger demographic more than an older demographic, or is it quite widespread?
Great question. And you know, I think the reason why we're seeing children who previously were undiagnosed with any mental illness, and you have to look at why would COVID do that? And I think one of the biggest factors is that the children's lives are completely disrupted. You know, right after March, what did we do? We went to remote learning. Remote learning takes the children away from their friends, takes them away from their teachers. For some kids, the school is the safety net. And for many kids, even really high-functioning kids, that level of disruption, losing their friends, losing their teachers, losing both adult and peer support is overwhelming. And these are not children who necessarily had prior, you know, behavioral health issues or mental illness. These are children who just could not cope with that abrupt change in that short of time. And then the ability of the outpatient services to really be able to ramp up and meet that need is a lot of what SB 14 was about. Mobile crisis teams that could go into the home and help out, those don't exist for children. That's part of SB 14 that has not been implemented. So you're absolutely right. I believe that a lot of this had to do with this dramatic change in the children's environment.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Our guest today is Dr. Tom Sherman, also known as Senator Tom Sherman, practicing gastroenterologist. I got it out. That's the last time I'm going to say it. In Exeter,
we use the term GI doc, and I, as Dan knows, I answer to anything. Hey, you work. People, you know, when I was a state rep, it was very confusing for people. So I just said, call me Tom. It was fine.
There you go. All right, Tom. Hang in there. We have to take a very quick break. Feltus and Kale will continue here. 103.9, 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. Feltus and Kale on this Tuesday edition. Our guest is Dr. Tom Sherman. We'll just call him Tom, as he mentioned prior to our last break. And we were talking about the mental health issues. And another issue that has been prevalent during this crisis has been the increase of use of illegal drugs and recreational drugs, whatever you want to call them. That seems to have gone up quite a bit during this pandemic.
Yeah, yes, you're absolutely right. This was already an issue. Addiction in New Hampshire, as you know, has been an issue for several years. It was increasing, and we hit a real crisis moment back in about 2015, 2016. And I was a state rep at the time and served on the Joint Task Force on the addiction and the heroin epidemic. I've continued the work on this. My district has some real areas of significant concern in terms of overdose deaths. But COVID has done sort of two things. One is it's inspired some positive changes in terms of interventions and treatment, which have led to legislation which have been, I think, put New Hampshire virtually number one in the nation in terms of what they're doing, and that's around telemedicine and telehealth. On the other hand, it's pulled, like so many other things that COVID has done, it's pulled the patient away from the providers. And so the ability for programming to continue in an in-person way or even a residential way has been threatened by COVID. And at the same time, you were talking before the break about the COVID impact on children, and we also talked about adults. This population of adults, whether it's alcohol addiction or alcoholism, or whether it's opioid or other substances, you know, crystal meth, is a rising concern in New Hampshire. All of these, as people lose their jobs, as they have more stress at home, and people who were in recovery are relapsing because they don't have the coping mechanisms and they don't have the support, as I just mentioned. So on the positive side, the telemedicine, that John Burns has done some amazing work. He runs SOS and has developed basically Zoom meetings that are confidential. You can remain anonymous. And they're, one of the really cool aspects of this is that he has worked across the country with other providers, and some of these meetings are literally national. So you are, if you are in treatment or in recovery, you can be tapping into this national pool of people who are, have a shared experience with you. And I think that's really revolutionary in addiction treatment.
You're listening to Felt It. Oh, go ahead, Tom. Go ahead.
No, so I think there's, you know, the negative is clearly there. And I think we need to take an entirely new look at how we provide addiction treatment in the state of New Hampshire, and I could talk about that for a long time, but I don't believe that the current system is the long-term answer. But I do think we've seen some real positive advances in this arena.
And you are listening to Feltus and Kale on WKXL 103.9 FM, 1450 AM. Our guest today is Dr. Tom Sherman, also state senator representing the Seacoast. We're talking right now about the substance use disorder crisis and combating it, and Tom and others' efforts to do so. One of the issues, Tom, that is widely recognized as a barrier to maintaining our treatment infrastructure is the reimbursement rates of treatment providers. And in 2019, bipartisan legislation, Senate Bill 5, was passed by the state Senate, 24-0, overwhelmingly passed by the House, vetoed by the governor, and then included in the budget, but taken out of the budget in April this past year, the reimbursement rates. So have you looked at the current budget in, you know, I know some of the details are just being unrolled, but rolled out, but where are the reimbursement rates in the current budget proposal by the governor? And where does that stand in terms of where the legislature is at?
Well, I think we have to recognize that there is a new perfect storm developing on addiction. Interest rates are tenuous. I'm sorry, not reimbursement rates are tenuous. Reimbursement rates, why they're so critical to all this is much of this is based on Medicaid reimbursement. New Hampshire has notoriously had among the lowest Medicaid reimbursement in the entire country. That means that we cannot compete with Maine, Massachusetts, Vermont in terms of recruiting and retaining skilled workers, whether it's mental health or addiction treatment. The second one, the second component to that is that if we don't keep pace with that, then we're going to fall behind. But at the same time, two of our federal programs are finishing up. One was the Integrated Delivery Network program, which was a multi-million dollar program that lasted 5 years that really allowed mental health incorporation into primary care. That's sort of a simple way of describing it throughout the state. The second one is the federal money that stood up the doorway system, which, again, I think is flawed, but that money is going away. So when you take away all that federal funding, which is multiple millions of dollars, and then you also, you know, kind of nickel-dime the idea of how to fully funding the providers of care, you are left with, just like we've seen with the kids in the ER, we are going to be seeing an inadequate ability to provide care to people who need it in New Hampshire when it comes to substance use and addiction.
And one of the many issues that you work on, Tom, just switching gears, going from health care and under that umbrella, obviously, substance use disorder crisis, mental health crisis, and the COVID crisis, all exacerbate each other, but you also work on issues restoring faith in our democracy, including an independent bipartisan redistricting commission. Redistricting happens every 10 years once the census comes out. Can you talk a little bit about that effort that you're spearheading, the work that's going into it, and what are the prospects of an independent, nonpartisan redistricting this year?
Yeah, I think the prospects, well, first of all, just to explain redistricting, this is one of the most critical parts of our democracy. When we look at elections in general, the whole goal, I served at the request and at the appointment of the Secretary of State, I served on the Select Committee on the 2020 election. That work resulted in both non-legislative and legislative interventions to make absolutely sure, I was prime sponsor of the legislative intervention that made absolutely sure that our elections were robust, like they always are in New Hampshire, thanks to the Secretary of State's good work on that, but also that they were secure. But then you think about, well, they're robust, they're secure, they're safe. Our absentee voting system is one of the most reliable in the country. Everything about our system is reliable, except the system is a little bit rigged. Or a lot rigged, depending on how you look at it. The system was designed in 2011 during the last process of redistricting to favor one party over the other. In the last 10 years since then, the Democrats have brought in at least four attempts to say, no, this isn't fair. If you're a Republican in Portsmouth or a Democrat in Salem, your votes should count. And they don't currently because the system is designed that that area is going to go, the Portsmouth area is going to go Democratic, the Salem area is going to go Republican. And no matter how there's a shift in the demographics, that is the goal. That's called gerrymandering. And so independent redistricting says, no, every vote should have as much of a equal voice as possible. And that's where developing an independent redistricting advisory council, which is what my bill would have done. And it, by the way, it was introduced originally through the work of Margie Smith, who is a state rep, prior to knowing who was going to be in power in 2020 to do the redistricting. So this was not a partisan issue. It passed the Senate in a bipartisan fashion. Senator Bradley was actually a co-sponsor of the bill, and it was vetoed by the governor. All of these efforts have been vetoed by the governor. So now we're in 2021. We're looking at 2022, where there will be redistricting, and it is my anticipation that we will be gerrymandered again so that one party will attempt to control the legislature for the next 10 years. And I just don't think that's fair to the voters. I don't care what party you're from. I don't think any of us should have our voice silenced in these legislative elections. And it's Congress, so it's House of Representatives, it's the Executive Council, State Senate, and House of Representatives. That's a lot of people, and it's a lot of voices that are silenced by this process.
Our guest is State Senator Dr. Tom Sherman, and we started off the program talking about COVID-19. This is the one-year anniversary of the first diagnosis of a case of coronavirus, COVID-19, here in the state of New Hampshire. And since then, about 1,100 people have died as a result of COVID-19 here in New Hampshire. So, what have we learned just about the spread of the disease, Dr. Sherman? We heard it was droplets. What have we learned about the spread and how it's contracted?
Yeah, it primarily, you're absolutely right. It primarily is droplets. You know, I do a procedure called an endoscopy, which is where I put a scope down into somebody's stomach. That's one of the highest risk procedures done in the time of COVID. And we are just covered head to toe with PPE. Interestingly, if you're kind of a nerd like me. The other end, the colonoscopy, is far lower risk. So these are respiratory droplets, not other ways of like stool or urine or those kind of things. That's why masking, double masking, keeping your distance is so critical to prevent spread. I think the biggest two pieces of news that have come out over the last few months is number one is the issue of the emergence of vaccines, which is phenomenal. But the other is the emergence of variants of the virus. These variants of the virus tend to be more contagious, and they appear also to be potentially more resistant to the vaccine. So that's why this is so important.
Tom, on the variants issue, there's the B117 variant from apparently originated in the UK. There's a variant from South Africa, among others. What is the efficacy or the effectiveness of these vaccines? We got a new one, Johnson & Johnson, that was approved, I guess. What are the effectiveness of these vaccines with respect to the variants, or do we not know?
Well, that's a good question. I think that it's still unclear. I think in general, the feeling is that the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine will be effective. Both companies are working on what's called a booster that would provide additional protection against these variants. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which, as you probably know, was just approved on an emergency use basis by the FDA this last week, that is less effective overall for getting the virus at all. However, its effectiveness is that if you were to get the virus, it would be a much milder form, and it has a 100% protection against hospitalization and ICU, having to be admitted to the ICU. So all three of these vaccines are effective against getting sick and dying, getting really sick. And the feeling that I've heard from many experts in infectious disease is that they will continue to provide a high level of protection against these variants. But viruses mutate, they change. And so getting the vaccine out and into the public and protecting the public, continuing to socially distance, continuing to wear masks, is critical to making sure that those variants do not, that we don't continue to develop new variants that are more resistant.
So there is that possibility that some of us may get a false sense of security because the vaccine rollout is underway, and you don't want to see that happen.
No, you absolutely don't. You know, New Hampshire, and I would say, unfortunately, New Hampshire has a very strong organized group of people who oppose vaccines. The problem, I'm a huge believer in personal liberty and privacy. I've worked closely with Neil Kirk on some of these issues. But when it comes to vaccines, when I think of the history of medicine, the two biggest advances in the history of medicine in terms of saving lives, the first one was actually development of public septic systems and public water supplies. Those were back in, I think, the 1800s. The second one is the development of vaccines. You think about polio, smallpox, and then some of the more common vaccines. These save lives, whether it's children or adults. With coronavirus, it is the answer for long-term being able to prevent the spread of this disease and the development of new variants. So until we have enough people vaccinated that we can be pretty confident that this virus is no longer a threat, it is critical that people continue to wear their masks, continue to socially distance. And I think people have what I would call virus fatigue, which is completely understandable, but recognize that this is a killer. And unfortunately, you know, we hear on the news all the time that it's killing the people we love the most. Those are our family members, our friends. And that's why we need to be masking and continuing these precautions.
Do you foresee us in the future getting yearly COVID booster shots, as it were?
But you mean similar to the flu?
Right.
I certainly hope not. My hope would be that two things. One is I hope that we can lift this virus through the use of the vaccines and really get a handle on it. And then we're going to need to see what the long-term efficacy of these vaccines are, whether they have lifelong immunity or whether they have limited immunity. You know, an example of limited immunity would be a tetanus, where you have to have your booster every 8 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. But with this one, we just don't know. What I think we have to walk away, if we're going to be smart about this, we have to walk away with some really strong lessons learned. We've seen Ebola, we've seen SARS, now we've got coronavirus. Ebola and SARS were limited. They were regional in the world. We didn't really get impacted by them, but we geared up to be ready for a pandemic. What we saw with the last administration was they basically cut that office out so that when the pandemic arrived, the one that really impacted the United States, we were caught flat-footed. I think this is a call to arms to really say, no, we can't, this is an issue of national security. This is an issue of national public health. And we really have to have a robust ability to respond to another pandemic, because this is the way viruses behave. And if you had taken COVID and combined it with Ebola, with the mortality impact of Ebola, and taking COVID, we would have seen scores more deaths than we've seen. And, we've crossed the 500,000 mark. So this is a real threat for the future. And to be smart, we have to think about how are we going to be ready to mobilize quickly should we see another viral outbreak.
You're listening to Feltus and Kale. Our guest today is Dr. Tom Sherman, state senator representing the Seacoast.
And a terrific guest he is.
Wonderful.
And we'll have you back. You've provided lots of great information. We only have about 30 seconds left. I know protecting drinking water is one of your crusades, and we're happy about that. How is the drinking water in New Hampshire these days?
Well, the drinking water is improving. The biggest message that I could get, we are working really hard on public water systems. But if I have only 15 seconds left, I would tell people, please get your private well water checked. Not looking at really the things like PFAS, but for the fundamentals like arsenic, which is something that's everywhere in New Hampshire. That is a leading cause of bladder cancer, and it's also starting to cause, we're starting to understand the impact on the neural development of children. So get your private wells tested. And if you don't have the means to do that, let's develop a program to make sure that we support so many New Hampshire residents with private wells.
Thanks so much, Dr. Tom Sherman. Senator Sherman, we appreciate it. We'll have you back, and thanks for a great chat today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciated the chance to be with you.
It is our pleasure. Thanks so much. 103.9 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. Feltus and Kale here on this March 2nd. And today, by the way, Dan, this is Read Across America Day.
Yep.
And also the day that the sales of 6 Dr. Seuss books are going to come to an end.
Really? I didn't know that.
Over racist and insensitive imagery, according to the business that preserves and protects the author's legacy. And so that news comes on the anniversary of the death, of the birth of Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss, who died in 1991, but his birthday was March the 2nd, and thus Read Across America Day. And I think Dr. Seuss inspired a lot of people to read over the years.
Well, we certainly read Dr. Seuss to our girls. They like a number of different books and stories of Dr. Seuss, Green Eggs and Ham.
I like Marvin K. Mooney myself.
You like that?
I read that to my daughters many times.
That's a good one, too.
Yeah.
And
there are so many. Don't cancel Dr. Seuss.
Well, you know, I'm not familiar with this news, but we'll take a look at it. But we're going to certainly it's a big a lot of the stories are a big hit in the Feltus household with our daughters.
No doubt. And my daughters, when they were your daughter's age, they enjoyed it, too. That'll do it for this edition of Feltus and Kale. Join us again on 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com.